Should we need a type rating to fly a Cirrus or Corvallis? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. Bob Miller is with me. Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot, and of Bob Miller Flight Training in the Western New York area. And we're here to talk about safety, as we do on Mondays. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
Hello, Paul.
You had something kind of controversial. I'm sure it was controversial. In the February edition of Over the Airwaves, you proposed that maybe it's time to consider type ratings, like you have to get now for turbine aircraft or aircraft over 12,500 pounds, for aircraft that are high performance, in particular, carbon composite aircraft such as the Cirrus line and the Cessna Corvallis. Why do we want to put this extra requirement on general aviation pilots?
I think for no other reason than the accident data. We've certainly had our share of accidents, high-profile accidents in the Cirrus line. We've not so much because we're not building quite so many Cessna Corvallis. But these airplanes are decidedly different than the traditional metal airplanes that we're flying in the high-performance category. I've owned and operated a Cessna 210 for many years now, and from a performance capability, it's very similar to the SR-22 and the Cessna Corvallis. But in many flying characteristics and respects, it's a whole lot different. And I can tell you, having flown many hours in both airplanes, that the Cirrus and the Corvallis, these are much closer to a very light jet than they are to a metal high-performance airplane. And this gets into the question, should we then extend the type rating requirement on these carbon composite airplanes? That's a question I think that really needs to be looked at.
Well, and you mentioned that obviously Cirrus tries to do the right thing in terms of mandated training for new owners. But especially in the current economy, there's a bunch of these things winding up on the used market, and they've been around for 10 years now, so they'll continue to do so.
Well, that's exactly right. That's where we're not getting any regulatory examination of the process. These airplanes are fast. They're fast when the engine isn't even running. They're fast. They're designed to be slippery. The wing loading on these wings are a whole lot heavier than they are on the metal airplanes. Their stall characteristics are different. And when we lose control of an airplane like this, you know, the one option is to pull the chute. That's a very expensive option on the Cirrus SR-22. Terribly expensive, and that affects us all when we lose control of an airplane and the only skill that we have is the ability to reach up and blow the ballistic chute. Here comes a $550,000, $650,000 airplane out of the sky, and it's destroyed by the time it hits the ground. That is not a way to affect a training or a safety mechanism. We need to train our pilots so as not to lose control of these airplanes in the first place.
All right, this sounds like an old debate about stall spin training, where the devil's advocate guys say, well, it usually happens at or below pattern altitude, so there's no recovery possible anyway. You know, how do you do this?
Oh, no, that argument is so specious as to border on the absurd. I know the AOPA's Air Safety Foundation folks have been saying that for years. This is hogwash, in my opinion. You can feel in your body when an airplane is slowing to the point where its pitch attitude is approaching a critical angle of attack. But you can only feel it if you've been trained to feel it. You can feel a spin coming on much more effectively if you've actually been through spins. So the best defense against spin accidents is not how to recover from a spin, but how to prevent ourselves from getting into one in the first place. You know, that's a subject for perhaps a whole another session to open up this discussion on spin training. But getting back to the Cirrus, for example, there was a case that was reported in ANN's PropWash here several weeks ago about another SR-22 driver out in Colorado. You know, he got a little bit disoriented on the approach, suffered a little bit of vertigo, and reaches up and pulls the chute. And fortunately, he lived, but the airplane is destroyed. And, you know, Paul, that's a $500,000 airplane. Fortunately, it did not come down in a schoolyard. But to build a safety system that depends upon a parachute to protect us from our own skill shortcomings is, again, I think that's ludicrous as well.
All right. Well, let's lay out a basic minimalist outline of a syllabus for this thing then. What are the elements of a training program to achieve a type rating in a GA aircraft like that?
Well, I think you go to the experts. If for the Cirrus, you go to COPA, the Cirrus Owners and Pilots Association. Cessna has a similar program, and I've taught it for the Cessna Corvallis. First of all, you go through an intimate understanding of the aircraft systems. The systems on those airplanes are complex, and they're redundant, and they're designed to be just that way. We had an incident in a Cessna Corvallis where we lost the engine because we idled it down at 9,000 feet to do some practice stalls. But the fuel boost pump was on, and when the fuel boost pump was on and we idled down to idle speed, the booster came on and flooded the engine and killed the engine. Now, here's a situation where I teach the course and failed to remember that, you know, when doing this, be sure the boost pump is off. And that's a simple example of where we really need to have drilled into our head what these systems on these airplanes are all about. So systems training would be number one. Then we need to get into the airplane with an experienced instructor, and we need to take it right to the envelope, right to the edge, to see just how recoverable these airplanes are and feel what it looks like to be in, not necessarily a full spin. They're not certified for that. But we need to give the kind of training that COPA gives their pilots and training on the Cirrus, and the same thing we do over at Cessna. And anybody who purchases a used aircraft should be required to go through this kind of training.
Now, how are you going to require that? I guess you'd have to require it as a full-on type rating.
Yeah, you would do it as a full-on type rating, or you could do it. I suppose you could do it as an endorsement, like we do a tailwheel endorsement. We go up and actually create a mandated syllabus or curriculum that says, you know, this is a carbon composite, technically advanced, complex airplane, and you need an endorsement in your logbook that you've received training to fly on this kind of an airplane. Now, the difference between an endorsement and type rating is the endorsement is not aircraft specific. This again, I'm not saying yes, we should do this. I'm saying that the problem is serious enough that there should be a very close look and consideration of perhaps doing this just based upon the accident data.
All right. When we come back from the break, Bob, I want to talk about something that may impact folks who are opening those barn doors for the first time this spring and rolling out their airplanes. My guest is Bob Miller. We'll be back with more in a moment. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Freedom through control. Cirrus has completely reinvented the personal aircraft and the entire experience of owning a personal aircraft. It's a bold new take on private aviation that we call Cirrus Flying 2.0. You set the schedule. You chart the course. You're in control.
Piperjet.
Piper Match.
Global Expansion.
Meridian, Mirage, Matrix, and more.
With so much happening at Piper, how can I possibly keep up?
Get informed. Get involved at facebook.com/Piper Aircraft.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves. And, Bob, this is the time of year when a lot of people have had their aircraft stuffed away in a hangar for a few months. And given the severity of the recent winter, an awful lot of people in the upper Midwest and the Northeast maybe have really had them stuffed away, maybe haven't seen their hangar in months. And this is probably a time when a lot of people choose to have their annual inspections done because, if nothing else, they want to make sure they found all the cobwebs. You related in the February edition of Over the Airwaves the story of someone who had an inspection done, and the way the inspection was wrapped up proved his undoing.
Well, this was a very unfortunate situation where there was no real shortcoming in procedure other than a well-intended mechanic had installed, at the owner's request, a windshield on an airplane that was undergoing a 100-hour inspection or an oil change, something as simple like that. And the mechanic signed off the logbooks that the airplane was ready to go, But it really wasn't. He was just waiting another 24 hours for the glue, if you will, to dry on the windshield, the sealant, and then the airplane would be ready to go. He basically pre-signed the logbooks as returning the airplane to duty.
Well, and in the meantime, he avoided doing the post-inspection run-up because he didn't want to vibrate the windshield until the sealant had cured.
That was the critical error that was made. His intention at the in the next 24 hours after the sealant was dried to do the run-up. The books had been signed. He was going to do the run-up, do the leak check, and then turn the airplane over to the owner. Unbeknownst to the mechanic, the owner showed up early and allegedly or apparently saw the logbooks and perhaps looked at the logbooks, saw everything was signed. The airplane was returned to duty, asked the line boy to pull the airplane out of the hangar. The pilot got in the airplane, started it up, took off, and very shortly after takeoff, the engine quit. The airplane came down off field, and the pilot died in the crash. And the inspectors discovered that as somehow along the way, either through a wrench that got mishandled a little bit in the engine compartment, had actually knocked loose an oil filler nipple on the oil cooler, just had cracked it. And the pilot started the engine. The engine now is spewing oil overboard, but since there was no leak check after the maintenance had been done, there was no way for the pilot inside the cockpit to see this oil leaking, and that was the problem. And so, clearly the point is, when returning an aircraft to service, absolutely be certain that that leak check has been performed. There's very few things that a mechanic can do to an airplane that will not reveal itself on startup that could cause the engine to fail prematurely. It will either not start properly, but if there's an oil leak, that's an insidious problem because the engine will start and run for 5, 6, 10 minutes before it exhausts itself of oil. And then when it does, the engine seizes usually in the air.
Now, would it be a reasonable thing to suggest to folks that even if they believe everything has been done properly, go run it up and check it yourself? Just take another look under the cowl before you take it out for the year.
Absolutely. I mean, we should be doing this. I will not take any aircraft directly into IMC conditions if the airplane just came out of maintenance. If my airplane just came, or any of our training airplanes just came out of maintenance, we will not take them up into low IMC. Sure, we'll take them up. We may go in the clouds, but if it's low IMC, that's no time to be experimenting with an airplane that's just undergone maintenance. The other thing to remember, too, the oil cooler in most airplanes is shunted off until that oil gets nice and hot. So if you're going to, when you do a leak check, be sure to run the engine long enough for the oil to allow itself into the oil cooler so that you're checking oil after it's run through the oil cooler, because that's a significant point of failure.
Well, Bob, a lot to think about. I know that a lot of people have not flown their airplanes for a while, so hopefully maybe this will make someone pause for a moment before they take it up for the first time this spring. We will catch you again for another one of these talks next Monday.
Thanks, Paul.
You can sign up to receive Bob Miller's thought-provoking monthly newsletter free by email at overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.